Flash Fiction and Romance today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Tom McKay writes flash fiction and novels. We'll ask him about both today on Scribble.
Tom, you came to my attention last summer sometime in an article in either the Argus or the Times in which you are described as an author of flash fiction. That's a fairly recent term, although it's really been around, I guess, since the 60s, but it's become really popular. What is flash fiction?
Well, it has several different definitions, I think. It begins with just the length of the piece. Some would say it's stories that are under 500 words. Some would say stories under 1,000 words. Some would say it's more like prose poetry. In my case, it's pretty much just short stories.
Mm-hmm. And is most of your effort on flash fiction? You write novels as well, don't you?
I do. I'm part of a writer's group that I belonged to for several years in Madison, Wisconsin. I used to live up there. I worked for the State Historical Society. And in that group, we critique each other's work, and generally I'm working on a novel, and others are working on lengthy pieces, too. Once in a while, we run kind of dry, and we're looking for something to critique, and somebody's got to fill in quickly, so I'll dash off maybe a real short story, and that's where this flash fiction
right
collection came
from. Right then
and there? Not right then and there. I'll have done that, but generally we produce things a few days in advance so we can send them out, and they get critiqued in advance. Then we meet.
Yeah. Well, what attracts you about flash fiction?
I think mostly it's just fun, in all honesty. Most of the flash fiction stories I've written are fun. I've got a little book called Junk to Think About. It's all flash fiction. And the back of it says, each story has a laugh, a tear, or a sigh. And I think that's pretty much true.
Can you give us an example? Can you invent some flash fiction right in front of us here?
Can I write some right in front of you? I don't have a piece of paper, but I do have a pen.
The first piece of flash fiction I remember reading is Donald Bartlemy back in the 70s, I guess. And this is it. The angel said to Bob, "The minute you say the word doyen, you will die." "Doyen," Bob said, and he died.
That would be shorter than any of the stories in my right. book, in fact. The shortest one in my book is 56 words long. And my oldest, my youngest son, who's not so young anymore, when he heard me say that, he said, "Well, Dad, 56 words long, is the main character named Spot?"
Can you read one of your flash fiction
pieces? Sure, I'd be happy to. The title of the book is Junk to Think About, and I'm going to read the title story of Junk to Think About. Buck ran his fingers through his long, scraggly beard, then rested his hand on his beer belly. He always checked his beard for crumbs after eating. Too bad he was working and couldn't really have a beer with lunch. He also didn't like the fact that at 55, his beard was thicker than his hair. Letting the hair grow long on the sides didn't count either. After all, he'd had long hair since he was 19. He covered his mouth for a belch. He would have let out a good one, but the kid was sensitive about that kind of thing. Buck shook his head. A sensitive junk picker. They spent most of their days driving alleys to hunt broken-down dinette chairs, rusted fence wire, and the occasional lucky piece of copper tubing. Buck wondered if he and the kid should be embarrassed to be seen together. They couldn't have been much more different, Buck with his hair down to his shoulders, and the kid's haircut something to make a Marine proud. The kid wore a clean pair of jeans and a sweatshirt every day, too. That didn't figure either. They were just going to get dirty by the middle of the morning. Buck wasn't a slob about things. Maybe it looked like he wore the same clothes every day, but he had three of his red muscle shirts. He rotated them pretty good. Good enough for a junk picker, at least. Besides, a sweatshirt would cover up the tattoos on both arms. It hurt plenty to get them. He was damn well going to show them off. Anyway, he sweat enough already. Nobody could call him a fanatic about his tattoos. He even changed some and gave himself the nickname when he and Sharon got married. It was the only thing he could think to do with the four letters tattooed across the fingers of each hand. The kid would never have that problem. Buck understood a person not liking tattoos, but the kid could loosen up a little. Even one of those tiny earrings you barely noticed would be something. Still, he couldn't complain about working with a kid. It had been more than a year, and the kid always did his part. Skinny as he was, he didn't mind grabbing one end of a heavy water heater while Buck took the other. Somehow, the kid was the more responsible one between the two of them, even though Buck owned the truck and ran the business. He knew the kid would be the one to fold up his paper lunch bag and ask about getting back to work. Just once, Buck would be happy if the kid leaned back and let them slack off for a while. He could see it wasn't going to happen today. "Think we should get back to work, Dad?" the kid said. Buck just smiled. "You raise them, you do your best, and at some point they go their own way. Always was like that. Always will be."
That's very good. That really is.
Thank you.
And, you know, but as you read this, it seems to read so easily. Was writing it that easy?
For that particular story, it was. They're not all easy, but for that particular story, it was. I encountered a couple of people, became friends with them, who were junk pickers. And I don't know, I held it in my mind that it's kind of interesting. You spend your day, you know, looking for whatever you can find on trash day.
And actually, you have published some of this flash fiction, huh?
This book, Junk to Think About, was published, actually self-published, through the River Lights Bookstore in Dubuque. They sell my other books, which come from other publishers, but they have a publishing service there. And I thought, I don't think a regular publisher is going to pick up a book of these tiny little stories like this, but I like the stories. So I thought, well, I'll go ahead and publish them that way.
Uh-huh. Now, your most recent one, how did that come about?
Well, The Old Guard is the name of it, and it's a book I wrote just to be funny, in all honesty. I have a book that I love called Can't Wait to Get to Heaven by Fanny Flagg. It's just so funny, and it's sort of bittersweet, but really, really fun, funny and touching, I would say. And I had written other novels of a little more serious vein, a couple of them, and I thought, I'd just like to try my hand at writing something funny. So I started out with The Old Guard, and I came up with a character who called herself The Old Guard on a sports blog she has because she played basketball, and she was kind of short, so she played guard, and that's where the title comes from.
Uh-huh, and she practices deception, doesn't she?
Well, she does indeed, because she blogs about all kinds of sports, and that includes football. And in the beginning of the book, she has blogged about football, and a sort of third-rate sports talk program, not on the level of Scribble, not quite as serious as that.
Well, you don't know what goes on when Scribble's not on the air either.
Actually, you'd have to sink a little bit.
Well, at any rate, this is not one of the top sports programs, but they see her blog, and they see a contact number on it. Well, she's blogged about football, how awful the Pro Bowl is, the football all-star game at the end of the year. And so she's blogged about that, and they see her contact information, and they call and say, "We'd like to talk to The Old Guard." And she says, "Okay." And they say, "Well, can you get him?" And she says, "Huh?" "Yeah, you know, lady, the football player," because they believe the Old Guard stands for one of the big fat linemen, you know, playing football. Well, she's so desperate that she decides that she just says, "Yes, I can get him." Well, then they say, "Well, we need him in half an hour. We just lost two guests for an interview, not unlike this interview we're doing right now." So she's only got one choice. She runs across the hall where she's got a new neighbor she's never met. He happens to be home from work. He's a pastry chef, but he's got a cold, and so he can't go into work that day. And she pounds on his door, and he comes to the door. She says, "I've got an emergency." And he says, "Oh, dear, should I call 911? She says, "No, I need a man." And it goes from there.
I particularly like the way, I like several things about this book, but I like the way in which you capture the actual hectic nature of a radio and television program. These two guys that run this program that she's being invited to participate in, you know, are totally inept.
They are indeed, and particularly Fred.
And they flounder around, and then all of a sudden they're on the air, and they sort of sound professional. I remember watching the first Garrison Keillor show. I went up to St. Paul to watch it, and 30 seconds to airtime. I mean, Keeler was wandering around with a sea of papers. Papers were dripping off his onto the floor. You know, the people were doing this and doing that, and all of a sudden it was 5, 4, 3, and at 1, everybody was at the mic. And things was, you know, if you'd see what was going on beforehand, you think, how are they ever going to get it together? And what you've captured is that what's going on behind the scenes and then what it sounds like on the air. So that even everything on the air sounds that is really stupid, right? Sounds profound. People want to hear more of it. So one of the things you've made fun of is so-called reality TV. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just amazing. So anyway, that part I like.
Uh-huh. I was going to sue him. I thought he was making fun of you and me.
Well, it could be. Sometimes you see us before and after the program. We aren't too different from those two guys.
Well, you know, you have to be a little careful about that. In this particular book, I had to make up a lot of proper names for things like radio shows,
right,
and advertisers.
Right. Right.
And in one place in there's an absolute airlines in the book, and they're not described in a very complimentary way. Let's just put it that way. I have a friend who's a genius copy editor, and she copy edits all my books, and it does it for free for me. And she checked every proper name in there. Well, she found out there actually is an Absolute Airlines. I had to change the name to Absolute Air Link because I didn't want to be sued like you were considering.
Well, you know, it's really amazing that you capture something of that, because it is true that very few programs, as you go through time, one program after another, very few are absolutely cut and dried and ordered and set, and away you go. As a matter of fact, I decided years ago, don't even try that. Just open the mic and see what happens. But that was, and the character, you have Paris and London, the romance between Paris and London.
Yes. Right?
But the character you give the man is misleading. And, you know, because of his very elegant ways, you right away assume that, well, maybe he's homosexual.
That's your problem, though, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's what you're pointing out, right?
Yeah.
We tend to stereotype, even those of us who think we can see through things.
That's right. And I was puzzled by that. And, of course, you resolved it rather neatly.
Right. I'd like to point out a single line that you use all the way through that I was really intrigued by, and that is Patty's frequent statement, she just knew it.
Yes, Patty uses that a lot in all different contexts. When she's happy about something, she just knew it. When it's not going well, she just knew it. So yeah. She uses it throughout the book.
And the reason, how did you go about, you know, the first thing I thought about has nothing to do with writing. It's Frank Lloyd Wright's First Unitarian Church in Madison, Wisconsin, which has a wall of flat limestone, unfinished edges. And it's the first time I was in college when I went there. It's the first time I had ever seen a wall meant to look as natural as a limestone cliff can look, in which every so often a piece sticks out 2 or 3 inches from the rest of the thing. And it looks so natural. And then, since then, in the 40 or 50 years since then, in various places I've seen architects try to reproduce that. And they can't. Nobody knows exactly how many bricks to stick out.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're either too many, or not enough, or they're too close together, or there's a pattern there that isn't any good. Nothing has come up to Wright's wall in Madison, Wisconsin. And I thought, the minute I started reading this, Tom's going to blow this, boy. I mean, he's going to stick it in too many times, or he's going to forget it. How did you know when to do it and when not to do it?
Because
it seems to me you've really done it well.
I think it's partly just understanding your own characters. I mean, when would Patty actually say this? You know, when would her feelings move her to say, she just knew it? And then, of course, I wanted to use it right at the end of the book, too.
I knew I wanted it to be there. Yeah, so. I mean, you know this is coming at the end of the book.
Yeah.
But you do it like Frank Lloyd Wright did as well in Madison,
Wisconsin. Well, thank you very much. I don't think I've ever had such a nice compliment.
But also the transitions, meanwhile.
Yeah.
One of the problems that authors face when they have a book where they need to change the perspectives within the same chapter is, well, how do you mark that change? A lot of time they do it with a little squiggly line or asterisks or something like that. But I thought I would sort of hark back to my childhood when on television you'd see Don Wooten among others, but you'd also see old time Western serials, and sometimes they would say "Meanwhile, back at the ranch."
Right. You know?
So I just decided I would play on that with a "Meanwhile," and then you shift it again. It was "Meanwhile," and then I even got up to a "Meanwhile" at one point.
I'm gonna quote you something from your acknowledgments at the very beginning of this novel, because I was intrigued by it. You say, a writer has to immerse himself in the lives of fictional characters. In real life, my wife Joyce cheerfully indulges the time I spend with these imaginary friends. How do you go about immersing yourself? I mean, how much of Patty did you invent before you started writing about her? Or how do you get to?
I had a good sense of who Patty was before I ever started this story, and the same.
Somebody you knew?
No. Just oftentimes, I will envision somebody that I know, so I can kind of physically envision a person, and so I was envisioning a person that I knew, but the person's not like this in terms of her personality. It just makes it easier to envision somebody. And I knew I wanted a contrast between Patty and Timothy, so I envisioned her as, you know, short and played guard and basketball, and Timothy as being a big, stocky guy and that sort of thing. So I can see the characters before I begin to write them, and then it's just a matter of.
So then, do you let the characters write the story?
No, I'm pretty.
Or do you know where you're going? At the
beginning
I
know exactly where I'm going. I have a process which I don't think too many authors use, but it works for me. When I have an idea for a story, I tell it to myself in my head.
Okay.
And then I know where the story begins, what's going to happen along the line, and how it ends. Then it's just a matter of writing it and filling in the details. You know, you can't know every detail in the story. But I know a story where a story is going before I even begin to write it. A lot of writers don't do it that way. They'll outline or they will let their characters go. A fellow who wrote Forrest Gump, I think he was quoted as saying, he just got up every morning and see what adventure this guy was going to go on. But I don't do it that way.
Right.
I'm sort of a dictator about my characters, honestly. They do what I want them to do.
How many novels have you written now?
Well, I have three that are published, and they're all short.
Uh-huh.
The first one, West Fork, was published here at Augustana by Eastall Press.
How did that happen?
I started writing in the mid-90s, and this story was prompted. I worked at the State Source of Wisconsin to provide assistance to small museums on all kinds of things, how to do exhibits, how to care for collections, how to raise money. In regard to raising the money, I used to go once a year to Eastern Illinois University, where they had a graduate program in museum work. And a friend of mine was a professor there, and she said, Tom, come down and do your fundraising workshop. So I'd go down and do a three-hour workshop. Well, the drive between Madison, Wisconsin, and Charleston, Illinois, is extremely boring. And so one year, instead of taking the interstate all the way, I decided I'm going to swing a little further west. I'm going to go up Highway 78 in Illinois 78, where my aunt and uncle had a farm south of Kewaunee. And that landscape has changed so much down there. There are no fences. There are no animals in the field, just big flat fields of corn and soybeans. You can't even recognize what it looked like in the 1950s. And I went through a small town called West Jersey, and they got a school there. A little gym on one end and six rooms running down the side. Hadn't been a school in years. They built them all over the place when the one-room schools closed, and most of them didn't last more than a generation or two as actual student schools, because the farms got bigger and bigger and bigger. There was nobody in the countryside, you know, living there to come into school. And so I thought, there's a story in there. And, of course, I'm an historian, but I didn't want to write any more history. So I made up a story called West Fork, and it was many, many years after I wrote it before it got published. I wrote it while I was still working. It was probably 12 years later after I'd retired that it was published.
How did you get a hold of Eastall Press?
There's a wonderful organization here in the Quad Cities called the Midwest Writing Center.
Right.
One of their active members is Susan Collins. And I was repeating this exact story I just told you in the same way about West Fork. And she said, well, have you heard of Eastall Press? And I said, no. So he said, well, you should go find out about them. And I did. I met with Karin Youngberg, who was the genius behind East Hall Press. And she decided they wanted to do that book. And that was my first novel in print.
How do we get your books?
The Old Guard is available here in the Quad Cities, independent booksellers, the Book Rack on Elmore Avenue in Davenport, the Brood Book on Harrison Street in Davenport, in Moline, Vicky's Rocks Readings and Books on 16th Street across from Trevor Hardware has them, and Exotic Imports has them in the mall, mm-hmm. South Park Mall. I notice you reach all the way up to Dubuque. River Lights in Dubuque has them. Doodad's Hallmark has them. In fact, I just did a signing there, and somebody asked me, have you ever been on Scribble? It was just Saturday. I got to ask that question. Down toward Burlington by the book has them, and Books on First and Dixon has them. They're available on Amazon and other internet formats, and they're available through Kindle.
Okay, so there's no excuse. It should be easy for you to get hold of a copy of The Old Guard, and I promise you, you'll enjoy reading it.
Do we have any time left?
We have a little time for the book bag, but you want to ask a further question?
I want to compliment on something else. This is probably the first novel I've read in 2 years that starts at the beginning and finishes at the end. it has become almost obligatory for contemporary novelists to shift back and forth between characters, I'm reading Where the Crawdads Sing, which is a very good novel, but the first chapter is 1952, then it's 1969, then it's 1961, then it's 1956. And I don't know why that has become so obligatory.
To make you stay awake, that's why.
I know, but and there's always sort of a reason for it, but it really was refreshing just to read a book that, starts at the beginning and then it quits when it's over. Well, and it's all chronological.
I appreciate that. All of my novels are chronological, although West Fork covers a broad span of time, about 25 years. So it doesn't go back and forth, but there are some big skips where several years are just skipped.
There are anyway, but this is an old-fashioned novel in that way because it's really the thing to do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, Tom McKay, thank you very much for telling us about The Old Guard and your flash fiction. And that little junk novella would be worth reading, too.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
And on to the book bag. We haven't delved into that for a while.
And I want to take this opportunity to go back to a writer we had on a couple weeks before Christmas vacation. She was Janice Bokoff, and she, if you remember, described herself as a Christian mystery writer, which intrigued us. She brought along a book called Cascade, which takes place in Mount Rainier. She knows what she's talking about because Janice was a geologist for 5 years working for the state and is familiar with glaciers and the other things on Mount Rainier. But I was intrigued by the Christian part. I do love writers who are Christian, C.S. Lewis, science fiction, G.K. Chesterton's Father Brown and The Man Who Was Thursday, T.S. Eliot. Is a Christian writer, I guess, and so is W.H. Auden, the poet. But a Christian mystery writer is something quite different. And so I'd never read, I guess, a Christian mystery. It turns out to be a whole genre all by itself. What goes on in this book is, first of all, a mystery, very well done, I must say, in which a woman a geologist is sent to see what's happening on the side of Mount Rainier. Some suspicious activity is taking place. It looks like somebody's trying to blow up a glacier, in which case a town at the foot of the glacier will be totally destroyed. And so she set out there. But in addition to which, she's a Christian. And so every one of her actions, every scene in this book, is interspersed with a scene in which she either thinks to herself or discusses with someone else, the pastor of the local church, for example, what would God want me to do in this particular situation? She's faced with falling in love with two boys. Which one does God want me to marry? And so it's a mystery interspersed with scenes in which I remember well from my childhood. I grew up in a very conservative town, and I can recall discussing under the streetlights at night with my buddies, you know, what if Christ came tomorrow? I remember sitting in the front seat of the theater watching the Western of the week, being a little afraid of what would happen if Jesus came. Would he want to catch me in the front seat of a theater? So these, for me, were once very serious questions.
Oh, I think they were for all of us.
They were for all of us. And that's the kind of thing that takes place here. What's interesting is that there are two forms of Christianity in this book. The church that she's associated with in town, which is very conservative, but not totally fundamentalist, and then a fundamentalist church, a fire and brimstone church, in which the minister literally believes that if your right eye offend you, you should pluck it out.
Oh.
And in fact, that happens in that church.
Oh,
so,
dear.
So we are faced with God giving two different messages to two different churches. So she raises some very interesting questions about God's interference. A person is killed. Why does God let bad things happen? Why does he let evil happen to good people? I mean, these are questions you and I are grew up with, right? And here they are in a Christian mystery. And it really makes for very interesting reading.
Uh-huh.
So if you've never read a Christian mystery, I would pick one up and take a look at it. And you'll find a form of literature that I've read nowhere else.
Yeah, that's Cascade is a very interesting book, and that it is fascinating to see how, you know, you talk about a novel, but there are different, I guess you'd say, flavors of novels.
Right.
And what an author brings to a story can color it in interesting ways and can take something that is formulaic and I won't say overlay it, but infuse it.
Right, infuse, I guess, is a good word for
yeah.
this. But it is, as a mystery, she does a very good job of telling a very traditional suspense
I
mystery.
I think that's important, too, that the Christian approach in and of itself is not going to work if you don't have a framework
right.
to hang it on.
And she's a good storyteller.
Yeah, well, and now's the time for you to write a novel from a Norwegian.
Yeah, well,
I mean, Norwegians are Christians, aren't they, Roland?
Well, after St. Olaf, that he's a saint because he saved all of Norway using hot bricks. He'd hold a person down and hold a hot brick over their open stomach and say, "Do you believe?" And if they said no, he dropped the brick. Well, it's fascinating how quickly Norwegian was Christianized.
Yeah, well, you wonder if it was worth the effort. Well, that'll do it for now. I'm Don Witt with Roll Tweet. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you'll join us next week for the next Scribble.